Before Gillian Flynn wrote Gone Girl, she wrote Sharp Objects. Now HBO has produced an adaptation starring Amy Adams, Patricia Clarkson, and Chris Messina.
Sharp Objects tells the story of Camille, a journalist who returns to her hometown of Wind Gap, Missouri, to investigate a recent murder. Once there, she also has to contend with her family.
Like HBO's adaptation of Big Little Lies, it gives some very good actresses a lot to do.
I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about Sharp Objects on today's Pop Culture Happy Hour. With us is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair, a Gillian Flynn fan from way back, Weekend Edition editor, Barry Hardiman. Hi, Barry.
Hi. I remember talking about Gone Girl.
Yeah. You talked about Gone Girl with me a lot.
On this podcast.
And we talked about her other books, including Sharp Objects. Now, before we get started, we did want to warn that the story is very painful and difficult. It involves self-harm. If that's something that you don't want to hear about, you should feel free to skip this one.
Otherwise, stay tuned for all the fun. Otherwise, sell it, Holmes.
Otherwise, stay tuned for all the fun. I have spoken a little bit to Barry and to Stephen about this adaptation. Glenn, you're a literature guy. What did you think
you're
of this adaptation?
Lion.
I listened to the book on tape a long time ago. And in my memory, this is completely different. It feels completely different because in the book, I don't remember any of these male characters making even the basest impression.
Yeah.
It was all about the three women. And the dudes were very ancillary. They've changed things up. They've added a lot. But for me, the big question watching this thing is this going to fill the giant Big Little Lies hole that HBO is desperately wanting it to? My first impression was there's no way it can because this is so unrelentingly grim and dark.
Yeah.
But then I remembered, well, Big Little Lies was about rape and violence. And
yeah, but Big Little Lies has a little bit of balance. It has that kind of slightly funny...
It also has... See, this is the thing.
The
it's not the dark and grim stuff. It's the unrelenting nature of this. Because, as you're saying, Big Little Lies has Reese Witherspoon and Laura Dern real housewifing each other, and that's fun. There's nothing like that here.
No.
What it is interested in doing is keeping you on edge. Like, the handheld camera stuff... We're always in the car with her as she is guzzling vodka.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to get the hell out of that car.
Yeah.
I wanted to ladybird myself out the damn vehicle because that is just unbearable to watch.
It really is.
I didn't want to be in the woods either, though.
Well, there's that. I think it might have some staying power. It might. It won't. I don't think it's going to be the memeable, gifable water cooler thing of the summer.
Right.
But there is a mystery to be solved here. And I think people are willing to put up with a lot of really grim, dark stuff if there is a puzzle to solve. So maybe.
Yeah. And I think the biggest connection between this creatively and Big Little Lies is that the episodes are directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, who did the episodes of Big Little Lies, but also directed Wild and some other stuff.
Dallas Buyers Club.
And I think the use of flashbacks and memory in this is very similar, to Wild in particular, in that it's very jumpy and you just get little bits and flashes. But in this case, I think it works very well because the whole idea is that Camille, this Amy Adams character, has a very fractured kind of funny working set of memories. And her perceptions of everything are not straight on. Do you agree with me, Barry?
I do. I also want to say this isn't going to fill a Big Little Lies shaped hole.
No.
But it will fill a you're more interested in a less misogynist True Detective hole.
Mm-hmm.
That's to me where it really fits. I will say where the violence and the sort of ritualistic nature of True Detective is sort of gives you that creepy, this is a bloody, bloody, violent miniseries. The most violent thing that happens in it, and I think I'm not giving anything away when I say, is something that a mother says to a daughter on the porch when no one is actually having a weapon except for their mouth.
Yeah.
There is a scene in which I felt like I had been stabbed. And meanwhile, you're kind of watching some stabbings too. So that, I think, is what's so sort of special about it is that I really actually don't like this kind of bleakness, this kind of skin-crawlingly sweaty and bloody and very, very bleak. But there's something I think really, really true about the nature of the violence between the women.
Yeah.
And for me, that violence between women, it feels more like a mirror image of Big Little Lies.
Right. Okay. What'd you think, Stephen?
Yeah, this was a tough one for me. few episodes back, we did an episode about the songs of the summer. And we were talking about summer entertainment as this frothy and light thing. And, you know, summer movies where things blow up and big pop songs that you can't get away from and your beach reads. And this, which premiered on July 9th. It is not summer fare, with the exception of the fact that one of the many, many details that it gets right is the pit stains.
Mm-hmm. And back stains. There's and a lot stains. Of like good back
this,
action.
This show, I don't know if they had like heat lamps on set to really maximize the sticky unpleasantness of the place that this show occupies. It's extremely well made. It has unbelievably sure hands involved. Jean-Marc Vallée, who did Big Little Lies, is very gifted. Marty Noxon, who, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Dietland, is the showrunner. She is a gem. Gillian Flynn, Amy Adams.
Gillian Flynn wrote some of the episodes in addition to
the source material.
Yeah. Amy Adams, Patricia Clarkson.
Patricia Clarkson, who is, you know, right up to the edge of over the top, but very, very good. You're seeing these incredibly skilled craftspeople who are getting so much right, but it is a very unnerving thing.
It is
not super binge watchable. And we kind of binged it to do this show. I watched 6 of the 7 that have been made available to critics.
There are 8 total.
And there are 8.
They've let us see 7.
Wow. Yeah. They don't want us giving away what happens.
And everything happens in the 8th episode, by the way. Everything. Uh-huh. If you've read the book, everything happens. Every damn thing.
I am sure that's true. But it sets this really interesting tone, which is, I would say, is slow moving and unrelenting. Mm-hmm. So it is. So
Glenn's like, sounds great.
So it's kind of it is a deliberately paced show, but you cannot look away for a frame because of this thing that Jean-Marc Vallée does, where these like split second flashbacks, and you're just seeing flash and flash and flash, and it's like, that image is portentous, that image is disturbing,
that image is just a bug,
that image is just a bug.
And you're just, but that's the thing. Yeah. It's just after when I in the middle of it, I started to just get, because I like all of us, we binged it. It suddenly you start to get a little jumpy. Like I would see a shadow and be like, oh, it's just the curtain.
Yeah. Well, I think what we're getting at here, and this is part of why there's sort of a nervous chuckle to this, is that what we're getting into is a distinction that we've sometimes talked about in different ways, which is not just is it good versus do you like it, which people have talked about a lot, but is it good, do you like it, and do you want to watch it are sort of three different things. There are times when I don't even want to watch something, even though I like it, because it's just not where my head is. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think one thing that people have become keenly aware of as there's gotten to be so much entertainment of so many different kinds, there is a difference between, there is no question that this is well executed. I think it's extremely well executed. Mm-hmm. Do I like it is really a question of, like, is it to my taste? And in a way, it is to my taste, because it is an interesting story about women. It has fabulous actresses in it who are doing the kind of thing I respond to. I like the kind of the handheld filmmaking aspect. I like the sound design is very sharp.
Music.
You hear
the
echoes.
The music is extraordinarily well selected.
Yeah, but
and
even
placed.
But even just the way footsteps sound in houses and the way creaks sound in houses, everything sounds big and empty. And I think that's very artfully done. But then that third question of do you want to watch it is a separate thing. It's like, what does it feel like to go in for this? And part of that is because I want to go back to something Barry said, which is it is about trauma among women. And very often, prestige television, HBO perhaps more than anyone, has made use of trauma among women as a way to develop male characters, who are detectives or fathers or husbands or boyfriends.
They're true detectives.
Exactly. Well, exactly.
True ones, guys.
True detectives.
They're playing a game of thrones.
And this, and this show is talking about trauma among women as a characteristic of women. Now, you can ask, couldn't we do shows that aren't about trauma among women at all? And I do think there's something to be said for that, but there's also something to be said for this kind of variant on that trope.
The truth is, as well, I thought it was beautifully made, found it, you know, gripping, also unpleasant. I was actually gripped enough to find that the binging of it was actually something I wanted to do. I mean,
yeah,
me too. I did not take as many Brooklyn Nine-Nine breaks as I thought I would, because I was actually caught up and gripped.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
I wondered if I would be as comfortable with it had there not been so many women that I love and trust involved, that the source material hadn't come from Gillian Flynn, mm-hmm. who I know is actually playing with the dead girl trope. So I'm good with
yeah.
that. I know that, you know, that I love Amy Adams and I love the work she's done. Marnie Noxon, I mean, please. So I felt like I was in good hands, and I'm okay with the Valet guy. He seems fine. But there were some moments where I did have that feeling of, this is going to get so many reviews that say the words unlikable female characters that in and of itself, that gives me a bad feeling. That shouldn't be what it is reduced to, and
yeah.
that gives me a yuck.
Yeah,
you know, I agree with that. And also, we are in a different position sitting in the studio right now, because normally we talk about a thing before anybody's seen it.
Yeah.
One episode has aired as we tape this, which means we could kind of look at the reaction. One thing that people are talking about online is the sound design, specifically the fact that they can't hear the dialogue. Now, that mm-hmm. surprised me, because we watched it on headphones
right,
on my computer, so that mm-hmm. didn't really factor in me. The other thing is that people are praising Amy Adams, of course they are. Gay Twitter is all over Amy Adams, as they should be. Not picking up on what Patricia Clarkson is lying down yet. Just wait,
it's
Gay
all
Twitter.
All out.
Yeah. Because, I mean, she
gets... So many robes to come.
So many robes to come. She's going to get bigger.
So much swanning.
A lot of swanning. That is the thing about the tone of this thing, right? So you have this, whenever anything is set in that house, that amazing house, you have this Southern Gothic island in the middle of this depressed community rife with addiction and poverty. So you got this Tennessee Williams play dropped in the middle of a Harmony Korine film.
Well, right. And the filmmaking techniques are all very jumpy and modern
right.
in the sense of like
a New York Times anthropology.
That it feels like the quick cuts and the handheld and stuff like that.
But that tone, that technique anyway, is becoming increasingly familiar so
yes.
that it is losing
right.
its power.
Right.
Just Amy Adams alone, right? She had in this, in Arrival, and in Nocturnal Animals, she can't go 5 minutes without being stopped short by some gauzy, abstract, well,
That's
art-directed
true.
Glimpse of a abstract, enigmatic memory.
Don't you put down Arrival.
No. He's mostly talking about Nocturnal Animals.
Yes, but I'm starting to worry about it, right? I mean, you want to take her out to lunch and ask her, are you okay?
But it's so cool, though, because early in Amy Adams'
Ella, how
career,
enchanted are you?
Exactly. Early in Amy Adams' career, we saw her in things like June Bug and, you know, even playing one of Leonardo DiCaprio's girlfriends in Catch Me If You Can. She
All
had
right.
this incredibly mm-hmm. sunny, upbeat, you know, when she was on The Office.
The Muppets.
She was sort of, and The Muppets. And gradually she's moved, and I think it has taken some time and some determination, being not only in Nocturnal Animals, which is a little more serious but still very glam
mm-hmm.
in a way, to Arrival and those kinds of roles. But I think this is even more like that, in that I think there is an ordinariness to this woman that I think is often very difficult for actresses who have spent a lot of their careers kind of glammed up
mm-hmm.
to do without it feeling overdetermined, kind
right.
of.
Mm-hmm.
I like there's a very, very ordinary quality to this character that I
and
responded
to
a lot.
The way she stands and
yeah.
sweats, like
mm-hmm.
her shiny, yeah. like, stoop.
There's an ordinariness, but also a remoteness. And there is a remoteness to Amy Adams' performances sometimes that this is really able to capitalize on.
One thing that I think is interesting, and I wondered what you thought about this, is that particularly people that have read the book, is that when I read this book, which was a while ago, I read it as a, you know, again, like a Gone Girl type thriller. It was her first book, and I was like, this is the thing I think I literally read it on an airplane.
Yeah.
But there's something sort of interesting that they took this, like, fun, like, I got this on that, like, it's crazy, like, they're writing words and blah, you know, and now I'm in this sort of this dark Tennessee Williams,
right.
Mommy Dearest land. It made me really like the book,
yeah.
as much as I enjoyed this, but
yeah.
I looked back and thought, that was a fascinating little crisp, sour grape.
Yeah. And I do think that whenever you are doing a story that is this tightly focused on kind of the physical trauma of bodies, I think whenever you're seeing them it has a slightly different resonance than when you're reading about them.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how vivid the description is, yeah. I always find that when you are seeing, it's as with any other thing that's very bloody, I never find reading about bloody violence as difficult as,
sure.
as watching
it. Not to mention the incredible sexualization of these women, particularly
right.
there's a whole gaggle of 11 to 13-year-old girls. Some are dead. And there is one, Eliza yeah. Scanlon, who plays the third child in this trio of problematic ladies, is incredible, but also so yeah. highly sexualized.
Yeah.
That's another thing where I was like, we're going to have unlikable female characters in review. We're going to have highly sexualized 13-year-olds.
And you know what's funny? The HBO description, and I think nowhere else, says she's 15. And I think they're just a little bit uncomfortable with that being a 13-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they aged her a tiny skitch. All right. Well, if any of you out there get a chance to see Sharp Objects, I'm sure you will be full of thoughts about it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. Tell us what you think. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for NPR comes from Zoom Video Communications. Video conferencing has changed the way we do business. Meet happy anytime, anywhere with Zoom, connecting team members across the globe. Imagine seeing 25 people on the screen at once in digital video. Share anything, a file, a video, a photo, via desktop, laptop, tablet, or mobile. Visit zoom.us to set up your free account today. And meet happy with Zoom Video Communications, zoom.us. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting your shortlist of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, this one was easy. There's a new Cartoon Network series called Craig of the Creek.
There we go.
It is created by Matt Burnett and Ben Levin, who are both from Steven Universe, which is one of my very favorite shows on TV. Craig of the Creek has been around for a few months, and it is delightful. And how did I come to finally sit down and watch it? There is an episode that just aired at the beginning of this week called The Vulture's Nest, in which the three principal characters in Craig of the Creek, which is three kids, ages 8, 10, and 11, they live in the suburbs, but they kind of escape to this kind of wildernessy paradise, and they run into an indie rock band called Bad Moves. And Bad Moves, I have never gotten to talk about my enjoyment of the band Bad Moves, because their drummer is our pal, Daoud Tyler Amin.
Who you have heard on this show.
Who you have heard on this show, and the Craig of the Creek kids sort of inexplicably run into the band Bad Moves, and who then teach them how to play instruments and talk to them about being in a band. And then they kind of adventure together, and ultimately there's this performance. And it is this wonderful, really charming show. It's very, very funny. And they did a beautiful, beautiful job animating all these people, including our pal Daoud, who is now a Cartoon Network star.
Yeah.
They have jokes. Each individual member of the band gets gags. And talking to Daoud about it, he was sort of saying, like, they did a lot of research, and some of the details about the band members' lives are actual details mm-hmm. of their lives. And it is so, it's a really fun and funny and light and charming show. The Vulture's Nest, an episode of Craig of the Creek on the Cartoon Network.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. I second that recommendation. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I am really digging Pose on FX, which is an 8-episode miniseries about ball culture in 1980s New York City. If you don't know what that means, that's if you've seen the documentary Paris is Burning. This is a fictionalized portrayal of that world. It was created by Brad Falchuk, Stephen Canals, and, wait for it, Ryan Murphy. Hold on. Let me finish. Yes. So it's got some of his stuff. It's melodramatic. It's often sentimental. It's preachy. But it hasn't yet gone off the rails. Like, the wheels have not fallen off this thing. And we are six, as we tape this, we're six episodes into its eight-episode season. Some coverage I've read suggests a reason for that. So apparently Falchuk and Canals wanted a straightforward, gritty, uncompromising, serious, prestige television kind of approach. And it was Murphy who said, you got to make it a little fun. You got to make it a little campy. You got to get a little sugar, a little spoonful of sugar to make the medicine go down. So the result is this very weird, but I think effective mix. You got Murphy's campiness. So there's a scene where these fierce trans women break into what I think is the Met to steal some costumes in a way that could not possibly happen. There's a scene where they swipe.
But should.
Yes. There's a scene where they swipe a Salvation Army collection bucket outside Bergdorf's or whatever, set to Darlene Love's Christmas Baby, Please Come Home. But what you don't get, and I think this is hugely important, is Murphy's characteristic glib cynicism. This show is completely sincere, to a fault, about the experiences of these marginalized people, black and brown, trans women, and to a lesser extent, gay men. I've read some very well-meaning critics who say, you know, this is great because these are the stories that haven't been told. And every time I see that, I'm like, no, can we just tweak that a bit to these are the stories you haven't heard yet?
Yeah.
Because they've been telling these stories. Mm-hmm. So, but let's celebrate the fact that this show is on this platform, which they haven't had before.
Right.
And it represents a chance to see and feel one iota of what this community has had to deal with back then, today. Ironically enough, given the subject of the show, it's a little rough around the edges, acting and writing-wise. The standout is India Moore, who, alone among the cast, she plays Angel, is giving you this kind of lived-in naturalism in her performance that just points up how artificial everything else is around her. So Pose on FX. Six of the eight episodes have aired so far, so maybe spend this weekend catching up.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week?
Well, that made me happy. So this is maybe too basic for a thing that made me happy, but I have to talk about it, which is the cover article on Johnny Depp in Rolling Stone. Have any of you read this thing?
Yes.
It's kind of sad,
it's
right?
It's kind of sad, though.
Hang on. Approach it with the right mindset, which is that, first of all, I did not anticipate. I thought this was just going to be your regular old star profile, sad, lost all his money. The words Paul Manafort and Oleg Deripaska appear in this article.
Mm-hmm.
Partly, it is such a deep dive because Stephen Roderick has spent all of this time, has done this incredible sort of portrait of this dark person who is like falling deeper and deeper into the quicksand of his life, who only appears at night. The writing is so good, and the way that, and the story itself is so crazy. Briefly, Johnny Depp, who had millions and millions of dollars, is now suing his money management company too, because he said that he was misled or that it was mismanaged. This is one of these articles that feels to me just so completely of this moment in every way, given that there is literally a Russian connection to it and this celebrity connection, not to mention Amber Heard's a little story that we have not heard. It was just a wild read, which I have not had from a Rolling Stone celebrity profile in a long time. And partly that's because this is, you know, the story itself is nuts. Partly it's because it's a well-told moment. It almost reads like a one-act play set in the dungeons of Johnny Depp's gloom. So if you've already spent seven episodes with sharp objects, you know, it really kind of pulls you down. But so that I do want to say it's worth checking out. And the whole thing is online.
There is nothing wrong with a nice pulpy celebrity profile, I like to say. All right. Thank you, Barry Hardiman. So what is making me happy this week? You can read on the blog now about the fact that I am playing with my Nintendo Switch. And what I'm going to talk about today is the game Stardew Valley, which is one of these games where you are going to make a farm.
I love it.
Grow produce and become friends with everyone.
So
it is everything that Glenn wants from a video game.
Turnips and dancing.
Vegetables and loneliness.
So basically, it's one of these games that looks like a cheap older game. It was originally a PC game. It launched in 2016, and then it came out for other platforms, and a lot of people play it. I'll tell you
right
now.
Let me just say, it looks a lot, for those of you in the know, like Alice Greenfingers. I don't know if any of you played that back in the day, but to me, that's what it looks like.
If it were called Alice Greenfingers, I think Glenn would like it one tick more. So you go around, you know, you have a plot of land, you clear the trees, you plant the plants, you wait, you pick a parsnip, you take it to town, you sell the parsnip.
Oh my God, I love it.
Glenn cannot understand why anyone would want to do this.
No, it's just, it's like video games plus toil. Yay.
But for me, and many people have talked to me about how it is part of their anxiety management, which I can completely understand because it is very soothing. You are just kind of carrying out tasks and it is predictable. And also nothing really that bad happens. Like the worst thing that can happen is you forget to go to bed, in which case someone carries you home. You wake up the next morning and they're like, we charged you 50 cents for the ride home. And you're like, that's cool. That's fine. But that's about the worst thing that happens to you. It's very low key, the lowest of keys, but I enjoy it very much, Stardew Valley. And also, if you are interested in watching my progress as I try to rediscover my old enjoyment of games this summer, you can follow it on the blog. There's an introductory post up right now, which is called It's Summer and It's Time for Some Pew 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 Research. Nice. I am not the first person to make that dad joke, no, I will say. No. But that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at Linda Holmes. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. And you can follow Barry at B. Hardiman. That's B-H-A-R-D-Y-M-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And our producer, Vincent Accavino, at V. Accavino. And you can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z. ZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the in and out music that you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
This is Peter Sagal. When we began Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we dreamed that our rude jokes would be, in the end, the appropriate way to talk about the news. And look, it happened. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.